This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Nuclear power was poised to experience a renaissance in the United States, and then the meltdown of the Fukushima plant in Japan occurred in the aftermath of a tsunami. All of the projects in the pipeline were put on hold, despite the fact that nuclear power has operated with relative safety here and around the world for decades. It's actually safer than banking. And no pun intended about that. It has to do with worker safety. But now, another way of generating nuclear power has cropped up. SMRs, or small nuclear reactors. These are mini power plants that can be installed all over the country. Now, years ago, we talked about big buildings, factories, neighborhoods, even individual houses getting off the grid and even selling power back to the grid from fossil fuel generators or from solar fuel, solar panels on the roof. That idea has not seemed to gain much traction. So can this similar idea, fueled by nuclear reaction, really catch on? Proponents say it's safe, but that view isn't shared by all. And today we'll look at both sides. Christopher Mowry is president of Babcock & Wilcox M-Power, an operating group of the Babcock & Wilcox company. Mr. Mowry is also president and CEO of Generation M-Power, a joint company formed by B&W and Bechtel to design, license, and build the next generation of nuclear power plants. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Travis Knight, who holds a PhD in nuclear engineering and is currently an associate professor and acting program director for the nuclear engineering program in the mechanical engineering department at the University of South Carolina. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
Nice
to
have you.
Me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about exactly what these things are, these small nuclear reactors. How small is small?
Well, that's a great question, and actually, small is relative. So what we're talking about here are utility scale small. So I think if you look at the power generation portfolio of a typical utility like Duke, you'll see that their sweet spot for adding power is more in the several hundred megawatt range, because that lines up very well with load growth and other demand changes that they have. So small is really in comparison to the size of reactors that have typically built in this country in the last 20 or 30 years that are 1,000 to 1,500 megawatts. And really what we're talking about here, certainly for M-Power, is something on the order of 200 megawatts. Our reactor is 180 megawatts.
And what does that mean? 180 megawatts does what? How much power is that? Put that in layman's terms.
180 megawatts, that's probably enough to power 20,000 homes.
Wow.
So that's why I say it's all relative. But that, if you look in other forms of power generation, for example, natural gas, a typical natural gas turbine that might be installed is in the order of that 200, 250 megawatt size range.
And so if you had, if you were Duke Energy and you had a natural gas power plant generating electricity, how many of those turbines would you have doing that in that one plant?
Well, that's the interesting thing here is they basically scale the size of the power plant by adjusting the number of turbines. Typically, when you talk about natural gas these days, it's called combined cycle natural gas. And what that means is that you have the gas turbine, and that'll generate power by itself, and then it'll also provide energy for steam that'll make a normal steam turbine run. And so they basically group these together in multiples. You might have two or four of these things together and build a power plant that's, say, 800 megawatts using two to four gas turbines and then also the steam that comes out.
And they could turn them on and off according to the load, the demand.
Yes.
And the same, it's the same operational philosophy, what this would do with these small nuclear reactors. You'd have more than one in the plant probably, or how would you gang them up together?
Well, that's exactly right. And in our base configuration is basically a two-pack. So that would be two of these together that would generate 360 megawatts. But the interesting thing here is that natural gas and typically nuclear is what we call base load power generation. And that's because it's dispatchable. It's there 24/7. It doesn't rely on wind or sunshine. And so when you flip your light switch, the electricity mm-hmm. comes on. And power companies need dispatchable power regardless of other forms that may be available.
Now, there was some question because of the way I worded the promotion for this show that these small reactors would be the kinds of things that might power downtowns or big, tall office towers or maybe neighborhoods as opposed to just the whole utility grid. That's not what these do. But in the future, if these catch on, could they be scaled down to do that? Or would that be something that's undesirable because of the nuclear aspect of it?
I think you'd need to segregate small modular reactors, or SMRs. It really encompasses a spectrum of different technologies. The technology that we're pursuing is really a re-engineering and fine-tuning of the basic technologies that have been demonstrated over the last 20 or 30 years. So the focus for MPower as an SMR is really around the economics, the practicality, and risk reduction as it comes to deploying these things and operating these things. And so we call these basically advanced third-generation technologies. But they are, from a practical perspective, utility scale. Mm-hmm. Then you have another set of technologies kind of that leapfrog to what we call fourth-generation technologies that are more in the R&D stage right now, and you can envision those being much, much smaller than a couple hundred megawatts, maybe in the 10 to 50 megawatt range. And when you get down to that size, from a pure power perspective, that could power a large office building, but there are a lot of questions about how you would operate that thing safely and how something like a power generation facility fits into the concept of an office structure. So there's a lot of unanswered questions. There's lots of promise, but those are 20 years out. And what we're focused on right here is a solution that's really deployable by the end of the decade.
Babcock and Wilcox is not the only company working on this technology. I think there are about 20 or so companies working on this. Where did this idea originate? Why are we pursuing this as opposed to these full-scale nuclear reactors that we've come to know around the country, including the Duke Energy
ones here? The heritage of our reactor is really interesting. It comes from our experience with the Otto Hahn, which was one of the very first commercial merchant ships that was powered by nuclear back in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. And that reactor was what we call an integral reactor. Basically, all the parts or pieces are inside one container. And so the heritage of this concept of an integral reactor, which is really what at its core an SMR is, really goes all the way back to the 60s. And there's been evolution in the details of this thing, a lot of engineering development over the past decades, but that's really the heritage of this thing. And in some ways, kind of goes back to the beginning of nuclear power. You know, the United States invented the commercial nuclear industry in the 1950s. There was a partnership between what was the Atomic Energy Commission back then and Duquesne Lighting, and they built a reactor in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, that kickstarted this global industry. And that was a reactor that's much more on the size that we're talking about today than the very, very large reactors that have been recently.
Yeah, the ones that we're familiar with are these enormous plants with these big cooling towers and that you can see for miles around. But yours are, as you say, modular. They're designed to be built in a factory, shipped by a rail car, and installed on the site that's been chosen for their existence. This is a whole new thing. Are we simply talking about the containment? You're just manufacturing the containment vessel, and that's what's being shipped? Or are we talking about more pieces of the pie than that?
No, it's actually much more than that. It just, from a typical round figure perspective, you can say that three-quarters, typically in the last 20 years or so, reactors have been built, the very large ones, about three-quarters of the total cost of constructing them is related to activities that happen out in the field. And maybe 25% is done back in a factory in a shop. And roughly speaking, we're trying to turn that equation upside down and basically build about 75% of this whole thing in a shop environment where you can improve quality and reduce risk.
We have had nuclear-powered Navy vessels for quite some time, particularly submarines. I want to bring Travis Knight, Dr. Knight, into this because he's the nuclear scientist. Is the technology in those vessels substantially different from the technology that we're talking about here? Because these vessels have operated for years in almost complete safety.
That's right. I mean, the technology is an evolutionary technology. It's really nothing more sexy than boiling water. I mean, so in that sense, it's not that different. So that the same physical principles that the naval reactors operate under, that large-scale commercial nuclear power plants, as you mentioned, operate under, the physics is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. They're smaller, I think, and they can fit into certain other niche markets, as has been mentioned, and have those benefits. But the basic underlying principles are the same.
That's one of the criticisms, by the way, of nuclear power in general, that it's a heck of a way to boil water. You're putting a lot of risk into boiling water. Is that a fair criticism?
There are other concepts, that can be employed to convert nuclear power into electricity. The problem is they have their own technological hurdles. I think the technology we have, while I said it's very unsexy, it's very productive and has proven very useful. It's 20% of our current energy mix. It emits no greenhouse gases, at least at the point of source. It's a low greenhouse gas emitter, comparable to wind or photovoltaics.
So that's where you mitigate the risk with the offset of no emissions, essentially.
Well, no technology is free of risk. So, and each has a different risk profile. Mm-hmm. You can run down the list of all the different energy technologies. Natural gas explosions, from California to New Mexico to Pennsylvania. Actual people have been killed.
Yeah.
But I have natural gas in my home.
In their homes, yes. And actually, I had a furnace installed last year, and the guy said, "Are you sure you want gas?" He said, "I wouldn't want that thing under my house." This is the guy putting it in.
Well, I have natural gas in my own home, as you mentioned. But I think you have to look at all the externalities. Everything comes with its own set of risks. But it's important to bear in mind that there's never been an injury or death associated with commercial nuclear power in the U.S. And you mentioned Fukushima at the start of the show. There's no injury or death associated with radiation from that accident.
And what about Three Mile Island, which is the U.S.?
Absolutely none. Even less.
But then you have Chernobyl. What was that situation?
Well, Chernobyl was a design that could never have been built in the U.S. It operated under very different. Boiled water, as I mentioned, is similar in that vein, but in terms of the physics that it operated under were different. It operated in what's called a positive feedback of void coefficient, so that actually when they made steam and operated in a way that was never intended to operate, the operators were doing things that should not have done. It had this positive feedback. It got out of control, and it basically a steam explosion. But that was a design that could never be built in the U.S.
So how does that design differ from the design we're talking about with these small reactors?
Well, I think you start with his comment. That reactor was never designed to make power. So it was being used for something it was never intended for. So that's number one. Number two, it didn't have any containment structure. So this concept of multiple layers of defense against unexpected occurrences was not really part of the design concept for that reactor. It was basically something that was out in the open with a steel shed around it, more or less.
I have 20 seconds. I'm not sure you can answer this question, so maybe we'll come back and get an answer to it. And that is, after Fukushima, we seem to have lost the political will to proceed with the building of big plants around the country. So why is this now a good time to proceed with the building of hundreds of plants? I'll give you a chance to answer that question when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNCTV's Festival 2013, presenting Protect Your Money with Dr. Neil Bernard tonight at 9:30. Information at unctv.org. Well, there's a lot going on in the world of politics without leaving North Carolina. We're going to take a look at Governor McCrory's first term so far. Hadn't even been 100 days. Calls for voter ID laws in North Carolina's General Assembly. The Panthers fight for stadium funding and the latest on a possible Charlotte Airport Authority. That's going to come up on Monday with guest host Julie Rose and a panel of reporters and political analysts talking about the latest political news here and across the state. Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama visits Capitol Hill to jumpstart budget talks, conservative Republicans regroup at their annual meeting, and a New York court overturns Mayor Bloomberg's soda ban.
Join the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about small nuclear reactors. It's a relatively new technology that is beginning to come online. One of the companies involved in that is Babcock and Wilcox Empower, and the president and CEO, the president of that organization, and the president and CEO of Generation Empower, which I'm not sure I understand the difference, but that's okay, is Christopher Maurer. He's one of our guests today in our Spirit Square studio here at WFAE. And Dr. Travis Knight is associate professor of nuclear engineering at the University of South Carolina. Just prior to the break, I asked about, since we kind of put on hold the renaissance of nuclear power generation in America using the standard old big plants that we've come to know in the aftermath of Fukushima, why is now a good time and why is there any political will now to build hundreds of these smaller vessels and put them in plants around the country?
That's a great question. Well, let me just back up and maybe challenge the supposition here. I don't think there's really been a change in political will. If you look at the plants that are actually under construction in the U.S. today, in South Carolina and Georgia and Watts Bar with the Tennessee Valley Authority, those plants had been on the books to be built before Fukushima, and the process of preparation for construction and actual construction has continued unabated throughout that entire process. And I think one of the things you can say about that is that those designs are considered safe, and the lessons learned from Fukushima really had no significant impact or change to the design requirements of those plants, certainly the brand new ones that are being built in South Carolina and Georgia. So it's not really a matter of political will. The challenge, and you said, hey, the nuclear renaissance is being put on hold. The challenge is an economic challenge, okay? It has to do with risk. From an economics perspective, financing, these very large reactors are in the 10, you know, if you want to build two of these, you're talking about shelling out $10 to $20 billion. And our view is that to restart the renaissance, if you will, it's not about technology, it's not about politics, it comes down to practicalities and risk and financing. And if you want to get these things built, you have to make it something that your average utility can afford.
Dr. Knight.
I would suggest, Mike, that it also has to do with just the economy. And if you recall, there was a downturn in the economy in 2008. If you look at electricity, demand tracks very closely the gross domestic product. And basically what that did was, you know, that set us, not set the country back, but also set this renaissance, as you mentioned, back about 5 years. It basically pushed those demand curves out,
okay,
you know, 5 to 10 years.
But Fukushima scared a lot of people, and we looked at the thing melting down, and I'm not sure if meltdown is the right word to use. We saw the plant beginning to deteriorate from the exterior, and we saw these workers being sent in and news reporters saying they're being sent to their deaths because they don't know what they're going to approach in there, and I don't know whether people died as a result of going in there and cleaning that plant up or not.
No, they did not.
They did not. But that scared a lot of people. So you are a nuclear scientist. This does not scare you. Why?
No, the technology does not scare me because I understand it and because I've studied it for more than 20 years. What you mentioned about Fukushima, these things are overblown because if you look at the doses that the workers received, some of them received in excess of what they would otherwise have should have received as nuclear workers, but none of them reached the level where they'd cause any health concerns. In fact, there were no health concerns.
But there are bars and restaurants now in Japan that test the food for radiation before they serve it.
Well, I think everyone has a right to be concerned and to take whatever measures they deem appropriate. And in an accident like this, it's appropriate to test the foods certainly around the plant and things that are grown around the plant. Rice was monitored, I know, in the immediate vicinity of the plant, and those will continue for some time.
In your mind, is there any difference between the need to do that, to monitor the food supply in Japan because of potential nuclear radiation concerns versus the health risks involved in coal-fired plants that spew all kinds of noxious stuff into the atmosphere that we breathe?
I think it's very important to point out, Mike, that radiation is not a hidden menace. Radiation can be detected to the lowest levels. I mean, in theory, there is really no lower limit to what we can detect. So the fact that it can go unnoticed or be some hidden menace is completely incorrect.
Are the health risks the same in your mind? Since we can be aware of both noxious fumes coming from coal-fired plants and we can be aware of nuclear problems, are the risks pretty much the same?
The risks are not the same, in my opinion, and I think I can substantiate that on science, because there's a direct correlation between particulate emissions and trouble with asthma-related deaths and mm-hmm. asthma-aggravated injuries and health effects. Radiation at low levels... there's a lot of controversy on the subject, because we receive radiation naturally as a consequence of cosmic rays from the ground, from the food we eat.
From granite,
right. Grand Central Station, right, the radiation level is much higher than a nuclear power plant.
Bananas,
correct. potassium-40. I'm irradiating you and you're irradiating me sitting here in this studio. Okay. But the fact is, we receive it naturally. The body has mechanisms that protect us against it. And there's even some suggestion that moderately increased doses actually stimulates that system of protection, because so-called radiation hormesis. So the radiation levels that we're talking about here, at least for nuclear power, putting Fukushima aside here, if you live within 50 miles of a nuclear plant, you're actually getting less radiation than 50 miles of a coal plant, because coal has uranium, thorium. It's in the ground naturally. When you burn it, it goes into the fly ash. So it's about 30 times higher from a coal plant, actually, because of that. So, but we receive radiation naturally. So radiation doesn't scare me. Now, of course, you want to avoid the types of situations we're talking about in Fukushima, certainly. But it's important to bear in mind that those radiation levels they received do not even arrive to the level of demonstrable health effects.
And when we're talking about these small nuclear reactors, we're talking about not one or two. We're talking about hundreds, ultimately, hundreds of them in various places around the country where the need for them is determined to be the highest. So the kinds of accidents that we've seen in the past at Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, could they happen on a smaller scale in one of these small nuclear reactor plants?
I think the what's important to note about some of the newer plants that are being built is they employ what's called passive safety systems, meaning they don't require pumps and motors in order to maintain the core in a safe condition. That is, remove the decay heat. That was the issue at Fukushima, was the loss of off-site power. And in this country, after 9/11 in particular, there were lots of measures taken by the industry to improve the backup power systems, putting in alternate cabling to bring in power into the plants, extra emergency diesel generators, mobile diesel generators, redundant power supplies. And certainly the industry, there have been studies that have been done to look at are those adequate and does more need to be done. But these new designs, both the large-scale designs you mentioned and as well as these small ones, they operate under this sort of passive safety system where gravity and natural circulation, things that we can rely on all the time, would be there to cool the plant.
Christopher Mowry, how many of these units has your company already built and tested?
We haven't built any of these yet. This has been a development program, really, that we launched from a full-scale perspective probably 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of seeking regulatory approval with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So that's something that we've started. But our plans, and we just received notice that we've been awarded a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy, that we're going to be working together with them to demonstrate this technology in the U.S., working together with the Tennessee Valley Authority. And the timeline for that plant to actually go commercial is early next decade.
And where do you see these plants? Obviously, you wouldn't be investing the kind of money you're investing in this and the time that you're investing in this and the other companies like yours that are working on similar designs. You wouldn't be doing this if you didn't think the potential for getting them out there and selling them would be great. So where would these things go? Where are the best candidates for these to be ultimately used?
Well, you know, you're right that we wouldn't be investing the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that's required by our company, in spite of the fact that we're getting support from Washington, from the Department of Energy. The fact is that most of this investment is coming from our business and our partners. And I think that there's obviously a business case to be made for that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be spending this kind of money. And to look at that business case, you really look globally. All right. And there's clearly an opportunity and a need for this kind of power in the United States. You know, we're in the middle of this natural gas renaissance, you can say. But it's just like a stock portfolio. You never put all your eggs in one basket, and no responsible utility would have a power generation portfolio that's 100% gas, regardless of what the price of the natural gas is. It just wouldn't be good risk management, wouldn't be prudent.
Which is why Duke Energy has nuclear and water and gas and coal.
That's exactly right. So there is a portfolio balancing dimension to this, which drives a focus on nuclear energy, even in the U.S. today.
And one of the good points about nuclear, at least in the, from the generation standpoint, is that it's emission-free. It doesn't pollute the atmosphere with as it generates electricity. There are problems on the backside of that, which we'll talk about. But people look at that in natural gas and say, well, gas is pretty much emission-free too, so it's not?
Not in terms of greenhouse gases, certainly. Okay. I mean, you're still burning, it's still a fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So from the standpoint of greenhouse gas emissions and...
But it's cleaner than coal.
Yes, it absolutely is, both from greenhouse gas emissions and...
And now we have the beginnings of solar, the beginnings of wind power, the beginnings of wave power, the beginnings of thermal power from the ground, beneath the ground. So there are a lot of people out there, particularly in our audience, who would say, well, why don't you stick with gas and wind and solar? Why do we need to muck up the works with something that is potentially really dangerous?
Well, I think, you know, again, I think a balanced portfolio is what we should all be advocating, of course. But we have to recognize there are limitations to wind and solar. You mentioned this, was mentioned earlier, the issue of dispatchable power. I mean, you can only count on it when the wind blows and the sun shines. There are some other, you know, engineering limitations as well. I mean, in terms of the quality of the power and the fact that it is so variable. There's a limit to about, I think it's around 10% that you would before you degrade the quality of the power on the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are engineering solutions to that, and batteries are being one of them, but that drives up the cost even more. So when you look at installing, you know, 1,000 megawatts of wind, because of capacity factors, I mean, if you really want 1,000 megawatts on average, you're going to have to install three times that because of capacity factors. There are these issues that have to be borne out. And what do you back that up with? When you back it up with a power source that can come up very rapidly, as was mentioned, natural gas. So you're relying on a fossil fuel to back up these otherwise supposedly clean sources. The other thing that is important to bear in mind is you mentioned that nuclear doesn't create greenhouse gases, at least at the point of origin. Well, we have to consider the full energy chain, both from mining through construction and the so even wind and solar emit greenhouse gases when you consider the full energy chain, because you have to pour the concrete, the steel, everything that goes into manufacturing the solar panels. There's energy input there.
But we have to mine uranium. We have to transport uranium.
I wasn't implying that nuclear is free by any means, but all the studies that have looked at this, they're at least on par in terms of about 14 to 18 grams CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour generation. So nuclear is just as green as wind and solar.
Okay. Mr. Maurer, your company says that small reactors have the ability to address challenges associated with building large reactors, like financial and safety risks. I think I understand the financial part of it, because they're smaller and they're self-contained. They're built off-site. They're shipped in. They're installed, as opposed to building from the ground up. What about the safety risks? How are they mitigated?
Well, there are just some inherent features and benefits of going a little bit smaller in this integral design that really allow us to take safety even to the next level beyond the current designs that have been approved by the NRC. Well, in safety, you have to put it in a context, in a yardstick, I think, that you can get some perspective around. And we're talking about a safety level here for MPower and these small modular reactors where you're talking about problems that might show up on every 1 in 100 million years type of event. So it's really, really low probability things. And this, to me, gets back to your earlier comment about Fukushima. And I think it's important for us all to recognize that the real lesson in Fukushima was not really technology, or there are probably some challenges there as well. The real lesson had to do with safety culture. Okay, and that's the real lesson from Fukushima. And I'll just reflect back onto the airline industry. You know, most people feel pretty comfortable getting on airplanes. You go down to the Charlotte airport. I just came back from a flight yesterday from Washington, D.C. on U.S. Airways. The airplanes, modern airplanes, are very, very, very safe. But if you look at around the world where there's issues, it really has to do with the safety culture of the airlines. So you need two things. You need good technology, and you need good safety culture. And as Travis mentioned earlier, the U.S. has a very strong safety culture that's driven by not only the regulators but the utilities themselves. And you combine it with a technology that has kind of a 1 in 100 million year type of inherent challenge to it, and you get something that I think most people would agree is safe, because you're talking about something that's at least as safe as getting on an airplane.
The design of the reactor you're proposing to build is housed in a fully underground containment structure under 8 feet of concrete. How does that compare with the kind of containment we have on the large-scale plants that we already have in existence?
Well, generally speaking, it would be the same type of concept, but what we've done really is put this thing underground. And the benefit there, of course, is you really remove it from a lot more environmental-type threats. You know, in the U.S., we don't have a lot of tsunamis, but you can imagine hurricanes, tornadoes, those types of things that really don't affect our reactor. And also other, let's say, man-made threats or issues from an airplane impact to other kinds of security threats. Mm-hmm. Just tucking this thing underground is just something that naturally makes sense and helps improve the safety performance.
Are the designs being done by yours and other companies similar in terms of the actual containment vessel and how it operates and in terms of its safety?
I'd say there's a number of different approaches that are being taken here, and I think the approach we're taking is somewhat unique.
Okay. Not everybody is thrilled by the idea of these small nuclear reactors, and we're going to hear from one of those people who has some genuine concerns, who's been on this program before, in just a moment. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Graduate School at UNC Charlotte, an urban research university offering 63 master's, 20 doctoral degrees, and 40 certificate programs. Information at evenhighereducation.uncc.edu. It's the weekly news roundup in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. The National Hour first. President Barack Obama visits Capitol Hill to jumpstart budget talks. Conservative Republicans regroup at their annual meeting in Washington. And a New York court overturns Mayor Michael Bloomberg's soda ban. Those are the big jumbo drinks he wanted to ban. Well, the court says you can't do that. Those stories and more, the topics at 10, the International Hour at 11. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
I'm Dale Spear, Director of Programming and Content at WFAE, thanking you for your support of our spring membership campaign. We surpassed our $550,000 goal thanks to you and your neighbors here in Charlotte. Now we'd like to know what you think. Please go to WFAE.org and take our listener survey and give us opinions about our programming, our announcers, and WFAE in general. With your support and input, we can continue to make WFAE a strong and valuable community asset.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about small nuclear reactors. They haven't come online yet, but they're being designed and built for use around the country in hundreds of locations, ultimately, if it gets approved. Christopher Mowry is the president of Babcock and Wilcox M-Power. Dr. Davis, they're building these units. Travis Knight is an associate professor and acting program director of the Nuclear Engineering Program at the University of South Carolina. Both of them are in our studio. We're being joined now by Jim Warren, the executive director of NC Warn. That's a watchdog group of nuclear power plants and how they operate. He's been on this program before, and he joins us by phone from Durham. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
You say that these small nuclear power plants make no financial sense because they require huge taxpayer subsidies. And we just mentioned the fact that Babcock and Wilcox is getting a $450 million, grant from the Energy Department. Would that be the right way to say that?
Well, we'll get a piece of it, and it's a cost-shared agreement where we have to pay most of it, and then they would reimburse us a small percentage. Maybe 20% or so of the total amount.
Okay. So you say that these make no financial sense because they require huge taxpayer subsidies. Aside from the infusion of capital that the government is putting toward M-Power's initial startup, would they require ongoing subsidies, Jim?
You bet they would, Mike. I mean, I see the SMR issue as a Hail Mary effort to try to resuscitate the very nuclear renaissance that has failed really badly after 10 years. And I'd like to point out, first let me say, all of the safety issues and claims about renewable energy that have been discussed so far are very debatable. But I want to move past that at this point and say, look, if the SMRs, which we heard have been under development for a very long time, if they were so good, then why did Duke Energy and the other Southeast utilities choose the Westinghouse, the giant reactor, for its for the Renaissance 8 to 10 years ago? And I'd like to note that Westinghouse reactor was being promoted as having many of the same features that are being sold as the benefits of the SMR, in particular the idea of a standardized design that could be largely built in a factory. That's what's being done in Georgia and South Carolina, and those projects are racking up huge cost overruns and delays. They are over a year behind now and even trying to pour the foundation at those projects. So the SMRs make sense if customers don't mind doubling our power bills and squandering any chance to avert runaway climate change, because the reality is the SMRs couldn't possibly be built fast enough to help with climate change. We don't have the time, the precious time, and billions of public dollars to keep pouring into those projects and propping up giant and profitable corporations who refuse to take the risks of these projects without heavy public financing.
Okay, stop right there. Let me give Christopher Mowry a chance to respond to some of this. What about these? I mean, the oil and gas industry is subsidized by the government, for crying out loud. The solar industry is subsidized to a certain degree, although President Obama got into great trouble because of his help. One, I think, Solyndra, who went out of business. What about the need for – why aren't you doing this on your own? Why do you need government help if these are going to be ultimately profitable for you? And what about the timeline that he talks about here?
Yeah, well, I think let's start with a quick fact check here. First of all, wind power on a true basis is at least twice as expensive as nuclear.
No, sir. Not in Texas, Duke Energy is selling wind power to the city of San Antonio and Austin for under 4 cents a kilowatt hour.
That's right, and you look at the production.
Nuclear could not possibly come in for under 20 cents a kilowatt hour, and estimates are that SMRs would be far higher still.
Christopher Mowry, go ahead.
Well, first of all, as a publicly traded company, B&W and its shareholders would not be pouring the kind of money we are into nuclear if we thought that we couldn't sell any of these things because it was too expensive. Second of all, there are no subsidies for nuclear power generation in the U.S. The only forms of power that are subsidized from production tax credits in the U.S. are wind and solar. So if you want to talk about market distortion and what drives utilities to install wind, it's because of vast production tax credits that artificially lower the cost for the utility.
And so when billions of dollars poured into nuclear subsidies by federal taxpayers for decades. So you can't discount those. At this point, the nuclear industry ought to be mature enough to stand up on its own. But
well, couldn't the same be said of oil and gas? Couldn't the same be said of agriculture? We subsidize farmers for growing corn, and corn is a fuel, and it's a sweetener, and it's a food.
Well, that's true, but the same can't be said for the renewable industry that has been left out of the public support for so long, and which, by the way, are growing rapidly in all private marketplaces and in competitive states around this country and elsewhere. It's only in these monopoly captive Southeast Electric markets that building any kind of new nuclear plant is happening at all, because customers are forced to pay for plants up front.
Dr. Knight.
I think it's important to clarify, and there are no subsidies for commercial nuclear power generation. I think what Jim is referring to is there has been a good fair amount of research and development that's gone into nuclear power over the years, and there the government has a clear interest because of maintaining leadership in the technology. If you go back to the Atomic Energy Act, it's very important that we maintain a robust workforce and qualified personnel, not only for the commercial nuclear power industry, but also for the Department of Energy and most of our.
And you see this as a job creator, ultimately. You say that the high-skilled, well-paying jobs in this industry are actually safer than jobs in banking because the accident rate is lower. Is that because of training and regulation that go into operating these nuclear plants, or is it something else at work here?
It goes back to, I think, what was mentioned before about safety culture. I think that's ingrained into the nuclear industry. And when we're talking safety here, we're talking worker safety, accidents. We're not talking about radiation mm-hmm. accidents or exposures. We're talking about falls off ladders and things of that sort. But I think,
because all of that has to be written up. Every accident has to be written up in a nuclear power plant.
Right. You cut your finger or whatever it is.
It has to be written up.
In the banking industry, I'm assuming it's paper cuts or something like that. I don't know.
Jim, you also call this a dangerous distraction from things we should be doing to combat climate change. But proponents say that putting these small reactors online in large enough quantities will reduce our need for coal-fired plants. And if one of these reactors can power 180,000 homes, I think that you said, Christopher Maurer.
Over what time frame is the real question, Mike? It would take decades to get this new developing technology up and running, and we simply don't have that.
If you got approval today to build these and install them, how long would it take?
Construction would be about 4 years, and the commitment we have made to the U.S. Department of Energy is to get the first one online in 2021.
And how far away are you, do you think, from being approved to do something like that? Because that could go on for 10 or 15 years, couldn't it?
Right, exactly, Mike.
So how far away do you think you are?
Well, we plan to submit the final design for approval next year, and typically it's about a 3 to 4 year approval process.
So we're talking about 8 years, 10 years? No,
approval in 2017 is when we expect.
So have other companies who are also working on similar designs, different but similar designs, are they the same place you are in the pipeline, or are they ahead of you or behind you?
We'd say that we're probably ahead by a couple of years in the U.S. Now, we do have global competition. And that's our real focus, is what's going on in Korea and some other places.
But if just one of these reactors can power 180,000 homes with zero emissions, that reduces CO2 emissions, I think, by 57 million metric tons.
But, Mike, the time frame just doesn't work. We can start replacing all coal-fired power plants in North Carolina immediately with proven, ready-to-go clean technologies, especially energy-saving programs that could replace one-third of the power plants now operating in this state. Rooftop solar is growing very fast, despite earlier comments. Duke Energy is investing heavily out west in solar and wind, and rooftop solar is already far cheaper than new nuclear power could be. We've got abundant coastal area wind. And we've got combined heat and power in this state that has the capacity right now to replace 10 large power plants. So we could phase out all the coal beginning right now. And by the way, Duke Energy has two giant batteries worth of energy storage in the form of pump storage facilities. It's only the old guard, the intransigent folks who are holding back this transition to a clean energy economy in North Carolina and all the thousands of jobs that it could be creating, and that's where we need to be going.
Dr. Knight, you've been shaking your head no.
Well, I think it's just, I think that the facts as to cost, I think, are a little bit exaggerated here, because if you look at the Energy Information Administration, it's the government analysis of levelized cost of electricity, the projections for new nuclear are somewhere around $100 per megawatt hour.
But you have to look at what's actually happening in the field, Dr. Travis. These plants that they're trying to build are having huge problems already.
Well, but even taking the, you know, the delays that you may be referring to, this is, we're talking about first of a kind engineering for many of these projects. There's a learn by doing philosophy here that once we, you know, we talk about a renaissance has to be more than just you know, one or two plants. And I think the other thing to bear out here is that these plants are being built for 60 years. You know, whereas I think the analysis by the EIA is, I think, somewhere around 30 years capitalized for all the projects. Be it wind,
so each of these small vessels can last 60 years. Is that what you're saying?
That's the larger reactors I know are being licensed for 60 years. The existing reactors.
That's if any of them are in fact completed at all, and that's in great doubt at this point.
Well, I think it's. You know, we built 100 plus reactors in this country. The idea that we don't have the technological skill and the engineering skill in this country to build reactors, I think, is a little bit misleading.
But nearly many as many of those failed during construction during the early generation. Over 90 reactors were canceled.
That goes back again. That's a common misleading notion, is that, you know, the cancellations were associated with Three Mile Island or others. Again, it goes back to economics and the drop in the gross domestic product associated with various oil shocks and embargoes back in the 1970s. There were many plants put on the books that could not have been built, and it just was a matter of economics and be able to projecting too many plants in order to recover the cost of those down the road.
In your view as a scientist, as an engineer, if we want to be energy independent in this country, must nuclear be a bigger part of the mix?
Well, again, you got to be careful when you talk about energy independence. I mean, roughly half of our oil is imported every day. Some 10 million barrels of oil, I think it is approximately.
But electric cars are coming on.
Right, electric cars.
We'll need more power generation capacity.
So nuclear power doesn't contribute directly to, you know, that side of the equation of energy independence. But you're correct. Electric cars coming online. That nuclear can then reach down into transportation, fuel cells. We look at alternative fuels, the contributions that nuclear could play to.
Let's talk about something we haven't addressed, and that is when you build these big nuclear power plants, there are major security features built in for acts of terrorism and airplane crashes into the vessel and things like that, because if that were to happen, if a terrorist were to take over a plant, terrible things could happen. We have 103 nuclear power plants in America right now, the big traditional ones. We're talking about, if this gets approved and this technology works the way you think it's going to work, hundreds of more of these smaller plants. What about the security issues associated with the smaller plants being in more locations across the country?
Well, first of all, I would posit that in terms of security opposite a terrorist threat, the most secure infrastructure we have in the U.S. today is nuclear, okay? And if you look at the risk profile and what you could think about happening, there's a lot of other things that could be attacked that could injure or kill people that are much easier to go after than nuclear plant. That's number one. Number two is that every requirement related to security, whether it's airplane impact or security against people attacking it, those requirements are the same ones that are applied to small reactors. So there's no relaxation.
Are they as easy to defend when you install them wherever they're being installed? Is the perimeter secure as a big plant? I mean, does it require more people, less people? Is it different techniques?
Great question. And all I can speak for is MPower. And the answer to that is that it's a lot easier because it's underground. First of all, there's nothing for an airplane to hit. So that whole question gets off the table. And as, again, as you can imagine, securing it against a terrorist thing, having your reactor underground is the best place to put it.
The other thing is that no form of energy, I think, except for maybe solar or wind, is free of an after product. There's always an emission of some sort that it comes from the production of energy. And in the case of nuclear, it's the spent fuel rods. We seem to have a terrific problem in this country of figuring out what to do with those rods. They're still sitting in cooling ponds all over the country because the Yucca Mountain facility was shot down. And if we add more of these reactors around the country through these small plants, what happens to the abundance of cooling rods?
Well, that's a great question. And the issue there, I would say, number one, the issue as it relates to the spent fuel is one of policy, not technology. We, from a technical perspective, understand what to do with it. There's lots of countries around the world that have made the policy decision and disposed of it. So it comes back down to waste and impact on the environment. And there is no form of energy, as Travis talked about earlier, that has zero impact on the environment. Even wind and solar has a bigger impact than nuclear.
Christopher Mowry is president of Babcock & Wilcox MPower and the CEO of Generation MPower with that company. Dr. Travis Knight is a nuclear engineer with the University of South Carolina. And Jim Warren, executive director of NC Warren. They are an organization that is a watchdog group with regard to nuclear power. Thank you for the hour.